Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay, Anucheda number 7 is discussing. I'm sorry. How the impersonal Brahman appears, what form the appearance of Brahman takes. There was a citation from the 7th chapter of the 2nd canto describing qualities of Brahman. And some analysis of that verse. Let me just read, paraphrase one paragraph from 7.2. The essential defining features of this undifferentiated Brahman are stated. It is pure consciousness and perpetual happiness. In other words, it is by nature such an entity which stands in contrast to dead matter and material distress, and is eternally what it is without change. It is the reality known as the self, the foundation of all selves. Inasmuch as the Supreme Self is self-manifest, and the object of transcendental, unconditional love. So it is implied. Brahman also appears with these two attributes. Okay, now we move on to 7.3. Atatasya sukarupa syajasratve hetum aha. Shashwat, prashantam, those two words are in the verse. Nityameva kshoba rahitam, tadvad oboyam, abayam is also in the verse. Baya shunyam, avishokam, also in the verse. Shoka rahitam, cheti. Next, the verse explains why Brahman appears joyfully, perpetually. Not just why is Brahman happy, but why is he eternally happy? And the answer is, it is always fully peaceful, eternally free from agitation. And in the same way, it is fearless, devoid of fear, and sorrowless, free from all sorrow. The joyful condition of Brahman is not the result of pious work. Okay, I didn't read the Sanskrit. Okay, Brahman didn't become, you know, happy by doing some sadhana. Okay, that's what it says. Nacha sukha rupa tve tasya punya janyatvam syad ityaha shabdo nayatreti. The joyful condition of Brahman is not the result of pious work. As the words, wherein there is no sacrificial language, state. There's no sacrificial language in Brahman. We're bombarded by sacrificial language. Well, not really, because we're not Vedic Brahmins. Most of us were not born... All of us were not born in the proper Varnashram system because there is no proper Varnashram system anywhere in the world today. So what do we know about sacrificial language? Maybe someone's, you know, imitating the mantras of the Vedas and pretending to do some sacrifices. But it's really, in Kali Yuga, it's all a sham. But when human civilization is in normal working order, civilized human beings are bombarded by sacrificial language. Their day-to-day lives are prescribed by the injunctions of the Vedas. And they perform so many ritual sacrifices according to the Vedas for the sanctification of their lives. And therefore, if they do that, they can be relatively happy in this world. That is life in the mode of goodness, which is very much tied in with following the Vedas and performing sacrifices. And performing sacrifices means hearing and following the injunctions of the Vedas. You don't perform sacrifice just by doing your own thing, by, you know, doing what feels good. To perform Vedic sacrifice, you have to follow the instructions of the Vedas. But the Absolute Truth doesn't have to do all that. He doesn't have to perform any sacrifices to be happy, and he doesn't have to listen to the Vedas. The Vedas are emanating from the Absolute Truth. So the Absolute Truth doesn't have to be following any injunctions. So there's no sacrificial language in Brahman in that sense. Even though all the sacrificial language comes from Brahman, emanates from him. Okay, continuing. This portion of the verse means to say that the kind of language with complex grammar, which is for ritual activity, for such purposes as Vedic sacrifice, is not active within Brahman. You can say there's no language in Brahman. There's nothing to describe. There's nothing to do. Why do you use language? The ritualist will say language, the only really valuable use of language is to tell someone to do something. But we'll be more liberal than that. You also want to use language to describe things that are already existing. Especially you want to describe spiritual things, the Absolute Truth you want to describe. Language is required for that. But language really, yatod vacho nivartante, when you're dealing with Brahman, language can't do very much for you. There's no quality, supposedly, to describe in Brahman. And there's nothing for Brahman to do. And even if you want to be a meditator on Brahman, there's no way to do any service or sacrifice for the pleasure of Brahman. Brahman's happy, and if you're Brahman, realize you're happy. But there's no reciprocation. There's no bhakti, no Brahma bhakti. So there's no service, no sacrifices to perform. Therefore, the sacrificial language just doesn't, it's irrelevant to Brahman. Shabdo na yatra. Puta karakavan. I mean, the verse just says there's no language with all of its karakas. We know what karakas are. The function of various words in relationship to the verb in a sentence. Well, all of that is absent in Brahman. There's nothing to describe, there's nothing to say, and there's no language in the impersonal Brahman. Just blissful silence. Okay, and then the last sentence. Kintu aupanisha dak purusha ityadi vitya kevalam upadashad eva prakashaka bhavati ityartha. And this is a different idea. Rather, only the Upanishads reveal this supreme in the fashion of such statements as the creator known by the Upanishads. So the Upanishads say that the Absolute Truth, the word is purusha here, but sometimes the word atma is used, is understood by the Upanishads. That is language, but it's not ritualistic language. The Karmakanda will not reveal for you the Absolute Truth. But the Jnanakanda of the Upanishads does reveal the Absolute Truth in words. So Upanishadic language, that is present and that is relevant to Brahman, the Absolute Truth. Okay. Let me read the commentary. Two paragraphs. The original transcendental sound of the Vedas is the prototype from which all language is derived. The verse just talks about Shabda. which we can understand is sound, but because it says Karakavan Shabda, inarticulate sound, other than language, doesn't have karakas, doesn't have parts of speech. So we must be talking about language, not just any sound, Shabda. But it doesn't say ritualistic Vedic sound. That's the interpretation. The verse itself doesn't directly say that. But the point being made here at the beginning of the commentary, the original sound of the Vedas is the prototype from which all language is derived. It serves varied purposes, but one of the most interesting to the great mass of humanity is the prescription of ritual performances for earning the karmic credits that purchase material enjoyment and relative elevation. To express what they have to say, the Vedas use verbs, especially in the vidhi-lin injunctive form. The essence of a Vedic karmakanda statement is the injunction, and that's typically expressed by the vidhi-lin. Yajeta, one should worship. And other major words of sentences connected to verbs by special relationships called karakas, such as subject, object, instrument, recipient, point of departure, and location. For example, is it okay to call subject a karaka? It is. Yeah. For example, there is an injunction, yeah, because it's expressed by the third case. Anupta karta tritiya. It's a karaka, okay. For example, there is an injunction, jyoti shtomena swargakamo yajeta. Bardhana was here? Do we have a reference for that? Any idea where that comes from? We found it for the Tapasandarbha? Okay, so we can add that later. One who desires heaven should worship with the Jyoti Shtoma sacrifice. Where does it come from? Taittiriya Samhita or something? Okay. One who desires heaven should worship with the Jyoti Shtomena sacrifice, in which Yajeta should worship is the vidhi-lin verb. Swargakamaha, one who desires heaven, expresses the karta karaka, or subject relation, and jyotishtomena, with the jyotishtoma, the karana karaka, or instrumental relation. Ordinary statements of non-sacrificial language are also constructed from verbs, their karakas, and additional modifiers. The absolute truth, however, is transcendental to both Vedic and mundane language. Yato vacho nivartante apropya manasasaha, from approaching which words desist, and which the mind fails to reach. Reference. I have to give a reference for it. I know the reference. I found it before. The Mayavadis misinterpret this as meaning literally that no words can describe and no mind can comprehend the Supreme. But if this were actual fact, then the Vedas would be useless for understanding the Supreme, which no living being could ever realize. Vaishnava commentators on the Upanishads, however, choose to understand such abhedavakyas, statements of non-difference, in a qualified way, rather than following the contrary Mayavad way of interpretation. How is the statement that words in the mind can't reach, can't contact the Supreme. How is that a statement of non-difference? No? I don't know. No, but that doesn't explain, that doesn't answer the question. Why is that an abheda vakya? Why is that a statement of non-difference? The statement is, words fail to describe the Supreme and the mind cannot understand it. But I refer to that as a statement of non-difference, a description of non-difference. How is that a description of non-difference? What does it have to do with non-difference? Yes, but what do we mean by a statement of non-difference, a abheda vakya? There are abheda vakyas in the Upanishads. What are they? I say statement of non-difference. They're not statements about the personality of Godhead. They're statements about what? Which soul? What is non? What's the point of what is the idea of non-difference? Okay, if you say tatvamasi and take that to mean you are literally the absolute truth, then that's a statement of non-difference, or a statement that says the absolute truth has no variety, has no qualities. Those are statements of non-difference. To say that there are no differences, no variety. Is that right? Yeah. So why is this a statement about the absolute truth having no variety? Yes. Because it can't grasp something that has no variety. Words can't describe it, and the mind has nothing to grab, nothing to grasp. That so it's an implied. It implies that's why the mind and speech fail to reach the absolute truth, because the absolute truth doesn't have any variety, supposedly, if we interpret it that way. Yeah. Yeah, microphone.
Because aprapya manasa, because what is an object of description needs to be perceivable, and for perception the thing has to be outside of the self. So, since the self and the supreme are one and the same, one cannot describe the self because he's not really different.
But isn't the self prajagatma, prajaprakasha? Doesn't the self perceive itself?
But that is only
swayam prakasha, swasmai swayam prakasha.
But that is not describable. That's only anubhavatmak. It can only be experienced, but it cannot be perceived or described.
Okay,
that's what the Mayavadis might be saying.
Yeah, that's what Mayavadis would say. But the Vaishnavas, I don't even know.
Vijayan, another thing is this.
But the absolute truth is pure consciousness. Yes. But that consciousness has no object, so you can't. The Mayavadi would not say the absolute truth is conscious of itself. It would deny that it's conscious of anything. It's just conscious. There's no object to the consciousness, itself or anything else. So yeah, so the self can't perceive, unless there's an external object, there's nothing to perceive.
Yeah.
That's the argument?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Because the self is non-different, there can't be any perception, because perception requires a separation of knower and known.
And another way, could it be traced to this history that the Mayavadis generally, the statements that they used to use to solidify their proposition, became known as Abheda Vakyas. Because these are one of the things that the Mayavadis used a lot. And
well, no, but there are many statements that really on the surface seem to be describing non-difference. If there's a statement that there is no difference, you know, nasti bedo, if there's such a statement, that it's obviously some sort of abheda vakya, it's talking about abheda. How to interpret it, there we have room for a discussion. But there are many statements that are unquestionably describing non-difference in some way or another. It's not just, it's, you know, for one group it's an abheda vakya, but for the other it isn't. There are many statements that are obviously abheda vakyas, and other statements that are obviously describing variety. And you have to be crazy not to acknowledge that. But how to interpret, how to understand in context and make everything consistent. The same Upanishads saying there's no variety, and then also saying, describing the variety. How do you reconcile that? We're not arguing that there aren't any Abheda Vakyas, that only the Mayavadis imagine that they are. There are Abheda Vakyas, but we have to understand them properly in the whole context. Yes?
Looks like to me that what have Nityananda Prabhu and Bharata Prabhu explained, such arguments for the statements being Abheda Vakya could only be given if someone already has a prejudice or a particularly slanted view. Because even if we do recognize that the mind and the senses and the speech, they can describe variety, and therefore if something cannot be described by variety, is imperceivable, but it doesn't still mean that I'm the same with that object. It doesn't imply non-difference. So in other words, what they seem to be targeting here, Mayavadis, when they quote this statement as Abheda Vakya, they seem to target the speech and the mind as means of perception.
But you see, we don't actually have a disagreement about which are the Abheda Vakyas. It's not like the Vaishnavas for the last 1,000 years have been arguing with the Mayavadis about which statements are Abheda Vakyas. There's no argument over. This, you know, the Vaishnavas also accept Yato Vacho Nivartante Aprapya Manasa Saha is describing some kind of non-difference.
Yeah. I mean to say that non-difference is not explicit from the statement itself. It's explicit from something like the background of the statement, because it doesn't follow from here.
In this case, it's implied.
Logically, it doesn't follow. In other words, it cannot be interpreted as Abheda Vakya by itself.
It can. If you just take a simple implication that you understand, you infer what's the reason why words and mind can't perceive the absolute. Because the absolute doesn't have the material distinctions. You know, we understand it qualified, material distinctions. But it's still a question of there not being distinctions. And that's implied by the statement, even though it's not explicit.
Well, that's correct. It means that the
So we accept this as an Abheda Vakya, but we understand the Abheda Vakyas in a qualified way.
Like, for instance, when Shukadev Goswami describes Pradhana in the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, he says something similar. He says, it cannot be described by words, there is no way the mind can understand it, it's
yes.
completely unperceptible, unexpressible.
Yes.
And but that statement doesn't mean that it's Abheda Vakya of myself and Pradhana.
No.
From that statement.
See, you're making it too specific. You're thinking an Abheda Vakya has to involve you, the jiva. It's just a description of some kind of Abheda, general Abheda.
Or Abheda within
there's
the
no
absolute.
Variety at all.
Or within the absolute itself, or between me and
yeah, it can just be in the absolute itself. There's no variety, and the you that you're saying, you know, that you're different or not, you're arguing about whether you are different or not different from the absolute. You're just an illusion anyway. There is no separate you.
But that's what Mayavadis argue.
Yeah, I know that's what Mayavadis argue.
Okay,
but anyway, it's an Abheda Vakya, even though it's not talking about the difference, the specific difference between you and Krishna, but it's talking about there being no variety. You know, it's a statement. And of course, to properly understand the statement, we have to qualify it. There's no material variety in the absolute truth. But it is a statement about there not being variety in the absolute truth, and we're not arguing over that. We agree with that, with the Mayavadis. We disagree about how to interpret it.
But they lump themselves with the Brahman implicitly. They do not specify it, it doesn't follow from the statement, but they imply that they're one with the Absolute. And that's why, based on that yes. premise, they interpret this tape as a Bedavakya in a very broad way, that they are one with the self.
Okay, but yeah, there is very serious difference on how Bedavakyas are understood.
Exactly.
The question about whether there are Bedavakyas, that's not a controversy.
I'm not arguing against that. Okay. I'm just saying that it requires a premise which is not falling from this.
Yes,
from this
yes,
tape.
Yes. Actually, the commentary is going to say something about that. Yes. We're getting into a lot of side discussions here. Go ahead.
We see a bit side discussion, but from this verse, Nayamatma Prajnil Labhyo, Namedrasana Bhukta Shudina, we can understand that it's not possible to describe absolute truth with ordinary words, but Yam Evasha Vrindatan Labhyas, if he desires to reveal himself, he can provide means for us to understand. Like Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he gave Arjuna the spiritual vision, this means. Because of which he could understand it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's correct. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So this is because our mind and our senses are material, but supreme truth is yes. completely spiritual, and only by spiritual means we can understand it. And these spiritual means are provided by Supreme Lord Himself.
Yes. Yes. That's the correct understanding. But let's go back to the text. Vaishnav commentators on the Upanishads, however, choose to understand such abhedavakyas, statements of non-difference, in a qualified way, rather than following the contrary Mayavad way of interpretation. The Mayavadis take the abhedavakyas literally and relativize the countless Vedic statements of difference. There are abhedavakyas, and there are also bhedavakyas that describe variety or differences in the absolute truth. So the Mayavadis reconcile, they take the abhedavakyas literally, and they relativize the countless Vedic statements of difference of Brahman with his qualities, thus stigmatizing almost everything said in the Vedas as referring only to the unreal reflection of Brahman as Saguna. Vaishnavacharyas qualify the Upanishadic statement. I got a problem with that. Which Upanishadic statement? I'm going to put a comment. Which one? Yeah, well, the one above is what I mean. But I have to clarify that. The way I say it is not clear. They qualify the above Upanishadic statement by explaining that the Supreme cannot be described by ordinary words or understood by materialistic minds. Or else, another way to explain it, that no one can describe him completely or understand him completely. The injunctions and their karakas that fill the ritualistic parts of the Vedas fail to provide substantial knowledge of Brahman. The Upanishads, however, are a special division of the Vedas, empowered to make him known by verbal description. Okay, the Upanishads have the special potency to reveal the absolute truth. Karmakanda doesn't do that. Another name, therefore, of the Upanishads is Vedanta, the culmination of the Vedas. Let me change that to perfection, the perfection of the Vedas. Okay. Then continuing, 7.4. Punat swasuka rupatve chindriya janyatvam vyavartayati shudam ityadina. that this condition of joyfulness is sensual in origin is also refuted. It's the happiness that Brahman is experiencing doesn't come from sense gratification. That's said by the words beginning shuddham, pure. Shuddham samak samat sadasatak paramatma tatvam, that line. It, Brahman, is pure, free from faults, and equal, samam, devoid of higher and lower aspects. Let me go back and read the Sanskrit. Tatva shuddham, dosha rahitam, samam, uchavachata shunyam, sadasatak param, karana karya vargad uparistitam. It is pure, free from faults, and equal, devoid of higher and lower aspects. It is beyond the manifest and the unmanifest, situated above the categories of cause and effect. Sat and asat here is understood to mean the cause and effect. Cause is unmanifest because the result is not yet manifest when it's just in the state of cause. When the cause turns into the result, then the result is manifest. So that's called asat and then sat. Kim bahuna ityaha maya cha yasya bimukhe yad unmukataya stite jivan muktagane vilajamani vaparayati palayati tato duram gachati ityartaha. Could someone read the Sanskrit for that? Going back to 7. No, in the verse. Back in 7:1. Maya cha. Okay, maya parait. Abhimukhe is there. I'm trying to pick out the words that are actually in the verse. Yabhimukhe, vilajamana, and parayti. Those words are there. Okay, because I'm supposed to put the words that are actually in the verse in italics, and I didn't here. Okay. Tato duram gachati. Iti artaha. Shri Brahma Naradam. What does that last sentence indicate? End of the Anucheda, for one thing, and then it tells us who's speaking to whom. Okay? Which... Yeah. Of course, that's not really essential information. He quoted the verse. He didn't give... Jiva Goswami didn't give a verse reference. So he's expecting the reader to find out where in the Bhagavatam that verse is if he hasn't already memorized the whole Bhagavatam. And the reader should be able to, if he can figure that much out, where the verse is, he should be able to figure out who spoke it to whom. But this is added at the end as a formula at the end to mark the end of the Anucheda. Okay, let me read the Sanskrit, the English for that. To indicate, quote, what more needs to be said. Why, you know, okay, we give so many reasons why the joyfulness of Brahman is not sensory, and also the other points before that, why Brahman is eternally joyful, how it is that there's no Vedic language or no ritualistic language in Brahman. That was all explained. And to indicate what more needs to be said. Okay, we said enough to explain about Brahman. You know, leave it at that. The verse then states that Maya herself is embarrassed in the presence of the multitude of liberated jivas whose attention is turned toward the Supreme Lord. And she flees, goes far away from them. The verse under discussion was spoken by Sri Brahma to Narada. Okay, so that's why I changed Prabhupada's translation, because Jiva Goswami reads it this way, that Maya is running away from the Lord's devotees. Okay. Then after that, there's a verse, a karaka, Jiva Goswami's own verse. Vyajyate bhagavat tatve brahma cha vyajyate swayam tatotra brahma sandarbo pyavantaratya mataha. When the ultimate principle of Bhagawan is elucidated, Brahman is also automatically revealed. Thus we consider that this volume also includes a Brahma Sandarbha. Okay, the commentary on this. It is known inferentially from everyone's... What's inference? Oh, inference is general logic, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of induction and induction, but inference is just logic in general. Okay, it is known inferentially, logically, from everyone's lifelong experience that happiness obtained from sense gratification is always imperfect. Now, not everybody realizes that, but smart people realize it by looking at themselves and everybody else. You know, the smart people can deduce this right conclusion from his own experience and what he knows of other people's experience, that sense gratification is always imperfect. You may still consider it desirable if you're less intelligent, but if you have any intelligence, you should see that it's always imperfect. Maybe you're satisfied with imperfect sense gratification, but it's imperfect. It is at best temporary and petty, and most often it is degrading. So if the happiness of Brahman were also sensory, those who are serious about liberation from material misery would not desire it. They wouldn't want the happiness of Brahman if it's also another kind of sense gratification. But as we are told in the verse under discussion, this is a transcendental happiness. It is not a mixture of better and worse components, desirable in one part, undesirable in the other. It is altogether outside the scope of the universal laws of cause and effect. When a conditioned soul is seen to enjoy an advantage in life or suffer a misfortune, the invisible cause of this is the reactive potency of what good or bad he did in the past. How the same soul uses his opportunity for enjoyment and for learning from his suffering creates new effects to be experienced in the future. But when a soul has attained liberation and is enjoying the bliss found in Brahman, there is no material cause of his happiness and no material reaction. It is free from such entanglements. That happiness is free from the entanglements of... Anyway, it has no material cause and no material effect. Maya, the illusory energy of the Lord, who deludes fallen souls, is ashamed to show her face before her master and his surrendered servants, even though she is also his faithful servant. Okay, that is Anuchet 7. Anuchet 8 is short. I'll look at it right now. So Anuchet 7 was about understanding what's special about the appearance, because Brahman is just a different way of looking at the Absolute Truth. What's different about that way of looking at the Absolute Truth? That was discussed in 7. Now in 8, let's see what we're getting into here.
Is verse Vyajyate Bhagavat Tatve, is that the end of the...
That's tagged on
Brahma Sandarbha? It says here, it's Brahma Sandarbha.
Well, that's I don't know. Maybe. There might be more to say about Brahman. Might be. Now, okay, there is a shift of topic. He has the word Atta, and he usually does that when he introduces a new topic. So, yes, you're probably right. I think we're done with defining Brahman. Atta Sri Bhagavad Avirbhave Yogyatam Ah. Bhakti yogena manasi samyak pranihite male apashyat purusham purnam iti vyakyatam eva shri sutaha. Now the qualification for realizing the manifestation of the personality of Godhead is described in the verse. He fixed his mind, perfectly engaging it, by linking it in devotional service without any tinge of materialism. And thus he saw the absolute personality of Godhead. Of course, that's the description of Vyasadeva's trance, the meditation. We have already explained this verse, which was spoken by Sri Suta. That's the whole Anucheda. There's not much discussion because this verse was already discussed.
It's about Sanskrit because previously Shurjaya Goswami, he used it apashyat purusham purvam.
Well, okay.
But here we have again purnam.
Yeah,
so what
okay,
is
I'll check that. I'll check that.
Is it correct?
I'll check whether it's pur. Maybe it's purvam, right? Because it was purvam before.
Well, we're just doing this section right now in the commentaries. In our Tika class, and Sridhar Swami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they both say these are alternative readings.
They're alternative readings, but is Jiva Goswami using both of them, or did no. I make a mistake here? So let me check that. For some reason, I'm not getting any diacritics. Okay, I'll just write it without diacritics. Okay, now, I have a couple of points to make here. One is, okay, we described what's special about the appearance of the way that Brahman appears. Now, naturally, we move on to what's special about the way Bhagavan appears. And I guess there's going to have to be a discussion somewhere later on about what's special about the appearance of Paramatma. Okay, now, Vyasadeva's trance is cited, his meditation. And then it said, we've already explained this. Where did we explain it? Really, it wasn't. It hasn't been discussed in this sandarbha. Where was it in Tattva sandarbha? 30th anucheda. I have here in the commentary 30th. Will you say 30 and 31? Okay, I'll make a comment. Also 31st. Okay, we'll check that. Okay, I do mention that. I try to always, when it says this is done somewhere else, this is said somewhere else, I try to identify it in the commentary. Because I try to, in the commentary, so many things are going on in the Bhagavad Sandarbha, I try to help keep the reader oriented, remind him what's going on. Okay, the commentary. The main reason the same supreme truth is realized in different aspects is that those who approach him have varying qualifications for this realization. Candidates for knowing Brahman should be pure in the thoughts and behavior, that should be their thoughts and behavior, and have faith in the truth of spiritual existence. Well, that makes sense. If they're impure in their thoughts and behavior, and they don't believe in spiritual existence, they're not going to be very successful in Brahman realization. I mean, from my commentary, sorry. my commentary is not based on Baladeva Vibhushan or anybody, because there is no Sanskrit commentary. This is just all gibberish coming out of me. Okay. To be accepted by the personality of Godhead as fit to enter his devotional service, one should become attracted to him by the practices of hearing, chanting, and remembering his glories. That's the qualification for realizing Bhagavan. Because we talked, I think in 6, about the qualifications for realizing Brahman. So it looks like we skipped over that. I'm adding that in the commentary, the qualification for realizing Bhagavan. Maybe it is discussed later. Okay, this verse describing Vyasadeva's meditation for the reception of Srimad Bhagavatam was commented on earlier in the 30th and maybe the 31st anuchade of the Tattva Sandarbha. Yeah, it must be 31st also. Okay. I think. Okay, we'll read 9 also. It's also short. Okay, I'm sorry, I misoriented you. This Anucheta is discussing not the what Brahman looks like, what the appearance of Brahman is like, but what is the qualification for realizing Brahman? Now the qualification for realizing the manifest. So what qualification does a person have to realize Bhagavan? That's the topic of number 8. And it's short, there's not much said, because it's already been said in the Tattvasandarbha, explaining the same verse. But text Anuchet 9 is going to cite a statement by Brahma, Lord Brahma, to underscore this. Tadittam Brahmana Choktam Twam Bhakti Yoga Paribhavata Ritsaroja Ase Sutekshita Pato Nanunata Pumsam Iti Shri Sutaha. And so it is that Lord Brahma also says, O my Lord, your devotees can see you through the ears by the process of bona fide hearing. And thus their lotus-like hearts become cleansed by devotional service, and you take your seat there. This verse was spoken by Sri Suta. Well, I got a problem there. The verse was spoken by Lord Brahma in the Bhagavatam. No, this verse, Twam Bhakti Yoga Paribhavata Ritsayoja Saroja. We're in Anuchet 9 now. Jiva Goswami is telling us it was spoken by Sutta. Well, Sutta is narrating it, but Brahma spoke it. So I don't know. I'll have to check the manuscripts. Yes? Let's see. It's, it's 3.9.11. Yes. Yeah. It is. Right. So it was spoken by Brahma, and after that it was spoken by Maitreya, after that it was spoken by Shukadeva, and after that it was spoken by Sutta, all four of them. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it slipped in, someone was copying the manuscript and made a mistake. Yes.
Because he would be repeating himself twice if he would be saying, see,
Sri Sutta?
And that is said by Brahma. He says at the beginning of the...
Well, that's interesting.
That is said by Brahma, and then he quotes, and then...
He might do that, even though he's already given the information, but that's the formula. You mark the end of your anuchet, especially this is a short anuchet. The reader might not catch that it's done, and we're moving on to another one. So he's using that to tell you, that's the end of the anuchet. Yeah. But yeah, it looks like a mistake slipped into the manuscript here. Yes.
Yeah, this question is allowed here or not, but it looks like in the text number 9, he's quoting the verse which states that the cleanness of the heart comes as a result of hearing, which gives a person direct perception. Your devotees can see you through the ears, and thus their hearts become cleansed. And whereas in text 8, it's a prerequisite for understanding him. So interesting, it's like from different sides. Is it done on purpose, or is it grammatically justified, this kind of translation, that the cleanness of the heart comes as a result of hearing alongside with realization of Brahman?
Well, I'm sorry. 8, 9 says that realization of Krishna, seeing through the ears, it means you can realize Krishna. So right. Bhagavan is realized by practicing hearing and the other steps of devotional service.
And thus the hearts become...
And thus
the hearts becomes cleansed, sorry.
By devotional service.
Yeah, as a result. Whereas in the 8th text, it's a prerequisite for understanding. It's required. Whereas in the text number 9, it's not required yet.
I'm sorry, 8, what's a prerequisite for what?
Maybe I should ask it on the conference. I'll formulate it and you can write it on the conference.
It seems like 8 is also saying that practicing devotional service, which has different forms, hearing is one form, mm-hmm. Okay? It doesn't say in Bhakti Yoga and Manasi, it says it's in his mind. It's mental devotional service, not physical. But it doesn't say which of the 9 processes. You know, it's not specified. It just says that Vyasadeva, in his mind, you know, used the means of Bhakti Yoga to see the Supreme Lord. So it's saying the same thing, that the personality of Godhead is realized by the practice of devotional service. So the prerequisite is the practice of devotional service. I think both Anucheda is saying the same thing.
So the Anucheda number, the eighth Anucheda doesn't state that, the verse doesn't state that purity of the heart is a prerequisite for realizing him, does it?
That was about the Brahmavadis, realizing Brahman, you had to be pure in heart. Uh-huh. That goes without saying. You know, you need that plus the extra special qualification for realizing Brahman on top of the realization for realizing the qualification of realizing Brahman is to practice devotional service. And we're not even bothering to say that you have to have a pure heart. That's assumed.
This thing of pure heart is also said in, well, more or less, is also said in Bhakti Yogena Manasi, Amale.
Yeah, Amale is there.
So both these verses are more or less saying the same thing.
Of course, Prabhupada didn't translate Amale. Yeah. But that's okay. It's not mentioned in the commentary.
In the commentaries?
I mean, you know, here I use Prabhupada's translation, even though he didn't really translate Amale. Yeah, oh, well, okay, but it's locative. It actually refers to the mind. Bhakti Yogena is an instrumental. But anyway, Prabhupada took a little liberty there. And for the purpose of Jiva Goswami's explanation, which he doesn't give any here, it doesn't matter, so I left it. I didn't even notice, you know, because I wasn't looking at the word Amale. But it's there. It's there. It's just that we're not mentioning it here. Missing in the translation, and Jiva Swami is not commenting. Anyway, they're basically saying the same thing, that if you want to realize Bhagavan, what you have to do is practice devotional service.
Kind of, because I think even Acharya say we did it in the Tika class.
Well, it's also there, but the first thing is Bhakti Yogena.
Okay.
It's just another qualification that the mind is amala. It's there. It's a qualification. And it is mentioned here in the verse. You're right, but it doesn't make the situation any different. Even though it's not said in the verse quoted at 9.
At least the way Prabhupada translates.
Well, it says paribhavita. It's a heart purified by devotional service. You know, a heart prepared by devotional service. That's also implying purification.
Okay, so it's the same.
It's not any different. Okay. Really. There's, you know, some details may be said in one and not said in the other, but they're both describing the same situation. Bharatram Prabhu. Let me read the one sentence commentary, and then we'll be done with the file. Diligent commentary on 9. Diligent hearing about the Supreme Lord with faith and attention from authorized sources is the necessary and sufficient condition for making one's heart a suitably pure place for the Lord to manifest himself. Is that okay? Any arguments against that? Okay.
There was this question about Jiva Goswami saying that Suta Goswami is speaking this, and in the beginning he says Brahma. So, I don't know, in mine, the copy that I have in this, maybe it's a mistake in the diacritics, but it says Shri Sutaha. That means it would have still meant Brahma, because Brahma is the son of Lakshmi, so...
Sutta with a short U?
Yeah, it's a Shri Sutaha.
But he's called Aja, he doesn't have a mother. Lakshmi's not his mother.
I have
less. He's never called Shri Sutta. Stepmother. Yes, yeah, she's Saraswati's his guru. But I don't know about. Okay, anyway. Well, okay, you have a short U.
Yeah, I have a short.
Okay, I'll make a note of it. I mean,
it may just be a mistake.
So Sutta. But I've never heard Brahma referred to as the son of Lakshmi. Okay.
There was another thing I wanted to say.
Yes, please.
About the eighth verse saying that which precedes what, whether Bhakti Yoga comes first or purity comes first.
Yes.
In the eighth verse also, Sridhar Swami explains that Bhakti Yoga comes first. He says pranihite means fixed.
Yes.
And then he says atra hetuhu, the reason for this mind being fixed, yes, is bhakti yogena amale. is it being amala because of bhakti yoga. That means bhakti yoga came
first.
Bhakti
yoga is the cause of becoming amala.
Yes.
Of course, you need to have some minimum purification to even start bhakti yoga. That's also there. But here it's being said that the amala is the result of bhakti yoga.
Yes. Yes.
The purification, yes. It's complex. Before you can even begin devotional service, you have to undergo certain purification. Okay? You can't be a total demon and materialist and very easily enter into devotional service. You gotta get some of the garbage knocked out of you before you can practice start devotional service. By the practice of devotional service, you become a lot more purified. Then you actually realize the Supreme Lord. And then the final purification is accomplished by that. So it's on three different levels. Before you even start devotional service, there has to be purification. There's lots of purification during devotional service. And the final purification comes after seeing Krishna. All three. Well, there's different stages of purification. From the very beginning of devotional service, even before the beginning of devotional service, even karmakanda practice is involving the preliminary purification. And all the way up to the Sarup city, you're still undergoing purification. Okay? Okay, thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Sri Bhagavat Sandarbha Ki Jai.